Imagine holding an ice cube right in the palm of your hand. It's solid, it has this definite rigid shape, and you can pinpoint exactly where its edges begin and end.
Right.
But then imagine that ice just melting into a puddle of water. It spreads out, it loses those rigid boundaries, but it gains the ability to flow.
Yeah, it completely changes form.
Exactly. And then, say the sun comes out and that water evaporates. It completely vaporizes into this invisible gas that fills the entire room. We all understand that this is, well, simply how matter works under different pressure and temperature. But what if the numbers we use every single day, like the absolute bedrock of mathematics, aren't just these static symbols scribbled in a textbook?
That is the big question.
Yeah. What if numbers themselves exist in actual states of matter, just like ice, water, and gas?
It's a wild thought, right?
Yeah.
Because it fundamentally changes how you look at even a simple arithmetic equation. I mean, we are taught to view mathematics as this rigid toolbox.
Right, like a wrench or a hammer.
Exactly. Something humanity invented just to count inventory or measure property lines. But the source text we are analyzing today suggests something entirely different. It proposes that mathematics is actually a living, responsive ecosystem. And this ecosystem is driven by one underlying, almost desperate goal, which is the preservation of information.
Today, we are taking a deep dive into a really fascinating mathematical monograph on the phase transition theory of number systems, or PTNS. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore a concept that, frankly, completely recontextualized how I view logic itself.
It's definitely a paradigm shift.
It really is. The premise is that number systems actually evolve. They literally change phases to prevent the loss of data when they are subjected to, complex new equations that their current state just cannot handle.
Right, so when an old number system encounters a problem it can't solve without destroying the very information that created the problem in the first place, it faces a crisis.
Like it hits a wall.
Exactly. But it doesn't just return an error code and give up. The theory argues that the structure of the math itself undergoes a literal structural phase transition to survive.
Yeah.
It adapts to create a reality where that specific information can be saved.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand how math can, melt, we first have to understand the ice.
Good analogy.
So the monograph begins with what it calls the solid phase of mathematics, which is the realm of real numbers. So this is the math you use to balance a budget or cut a piece of wood. It's represented by the symbol R. Real numbers represent definite fixed points on a one-dimensional line, like a three is exactly a three.
Right, it sits in one spot and it does not move. The defining characteristic of this solid phase is that every element is a distinct, solitary point.
Yeah.
And the operations allowed, like addition, subtraction, multiplication, are highly deterministic and rigid, but there is this critical vulnerability built into solid math.
Which is
Well, mixing these solid points inherently destroys their history.
And when I first read that, I really had a hard time grasping it. I mean, if I add 2 + 3, I get 5.
Yeah.
I solved the problem. I didn't think I lost anything in that process.
Most people don't.
But the source frames this beautifully with the concept of reversibility, because if I walk up to you and just hand you a piece of paper with a 5 written on it, you have absolutely no idea where that 5 came from.
Not at all.
Did it come from 2 + 3, 4 + 1, a million minus 999,995?
It's impossible to know.
It's like taking two intricately carved pieces of metal, say, one shaped like a 2, one shaped like a 3, and just melting them down into a single uniform lump. Their original identities are completely erased.
Exactly. The mixing of two reals destroys the identity
Yeah.
of the sums. You only have the lump of metal left.
You're right.
But, while addition causes a mild loss of history, it doesn't actually break the system.
Right.
The fatal blow for the solid phase, the true trigger for a phase transition, happens when the system encounters an equation that demands a physical impossibility within that rigid structure.
And in the solid phase of real numbers, that trigger is the equation x squared plus 1 equals 0.
Yes.
Because if you try to isolate x, you have to find a number that, when multiplied by itself, equals negative 1. And on a rigid solid number line, that simply cannot exist.
Right, because a negative times a negative is a positive.
And a positive times a positive is a positive. You are trapped in a one-dimensional straitjacket.
You really are.
Yeah.
So within the real numbers, the operation simply fails. The mathematical statement that there is an object whose square is negative one is entirely suppressed.
It's like data that just can't be written to the hard drive.
Exactly. It's data that cannot be written to the hard drive of real numbers. But mathematics, if we follow this universal mandate of information preservation, It cannot allow that data to be discarded.
So the system has to adapt. It undergoes a phase transition to give that lost information a place to live. We invent the imaginary unit, I, and we transition into the realm of complex numbers denoted by C.
What's fascinating here is how the monograph describes the specific operator that facilitates this. It's known as the free functor that adjoins I.
Oh, right.
Now, we don't need to get bogged down in the functor formulas, but what this operator physically does to the math is crucial. It literally melts the rigid, one-dimensional number line. It allows it to spread out into a two-dimensional plane.
Just like ice melting into water.
Yes. The mathematical space becomes fluid.
We've entered the liquid phase. Complex numbers have a real part and an imaginary part. So instead of just sliding left and right on a single rigid line, you can move up, down, diagonally, and, well, in circles across a two-dimensional surface.
Exactly. By breaking out of the single dimension, the liquid phase supports two-dimensional flow. Every complex number now encodes two distinct pieces of information.
A magnitude and a phase, right?
Right. The magnitude tells you how far away the point is from the center, and the phase tells you its directional angle. So if we go back to your melted metal analogy, when you add two complex numbers together, you aren't just smelting them into an anonymous lump anymore.
Because you're adding vectors, right? You're actually combining arrows.
Yes, exactly.
The resulting point on the complex plane actually retains the geometric fingerprints of the arrows that created it. It perfectly preserves the information.
It does. The liquid phase allows polynomials to resolve completely. In fact, the fundamental theorem of algebra guarantees that no polynomial information is ever lost in this liquid phase.
Wow.
Yeah, it is considered maximally closed for those types of equations. It's a highly functional system that links perfectly to classical physics, electrical engineering, and even basic quantum amplitudes.
But that brings up a really, you know, obvious question. The liquid phase is so robust and it's maximally closed, so no data is lost. Why do we need to keep going? I mean, we have the ice, we melted it into water, the water works perfectly. What could possibly break the liquid phase?
Well, what breaks the liquid phase isn't an abstract mathematical paradox. It is the physical reality of the universe itself, specifically quantum superposition.
Of course. It's always quantum mechanics that show up to ruin a perfectly tidy mathematical model.
Always. It forces the issue, because a quantum particle state isn't a single fixed point in space. It is a wave function.
Right.
The source text provides this brilliant stress test for the liquid phase to illustrate this limitation. Imagine a free quantum particle with a specific mass. Now, place this particle in an equal superposition of two Gaussian wave packets.
Okay, I'm visualizing it.
One packet is centered at position zero, and the other is centered some distance away, let's say at position L.
Let me try to logic this out for a second, because my instinct is to just use the liquid phase we just built. We just established that complex numbers encode magnitude and phase perfectly, right?
We did.
So why can't we just assign a complex number to the packet at zero and another complex number to the packet at L and then calculate the probability? We have the 2D plane. Let's just use it.
It's a very logical assumption, but the text thoroughly dismantles it. The problem is that a complex number, even with its dual information of magnitude and phase, is ultimately still just a single dimensionless point on a surface.
Oh.
Yeah. If you try to use a complex number to represent a wave packet, you completely fail to encode the spatial geometry of that wave. A wave packet has a width. It has a specific distribution curve. A point does not.
Ah, I see. So a complex number can tell me how much in what direction, but it can't tell me what shape.
Exactly. You lose the information about the widths of the wave packets. You lose their specific distribution across the space between 0 and L. And most critically, you completely lose the interference pattern that happens when those two waves overlap.
Wow.
If you rely on the liquid phase, all that physical data is just destroyed.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the math realizes it's about to drop all this vital quantum data, right? So it has to transition again. If a complex number is a single droplet of water in a puddle, the only way to capture the full, smeared out, overlapping reality of that quantum wave is for the numbers to vaporize. They have to evaporate into the gas phase.
Beautifully put. We enter the realm of function spaces, specifically a Hilbert space, denoted as L squared. In this gas phase, the foundational numbers we are working with are no longer points at all.
They're functions now.
Yes, they are entire delocalized functions floating over an entire coordinate space.
So the math completely changes its identity. A number isn't indicating where something is anymore. The number is the entire cloud of probability of where it could be.
Let's look at how this gas phase perfectly preserves all the data that the liquid phase would have annihilated. In the gas phase, your starting point, your initial state, is a full function representing those two Gaussian wave packets.
Okay.
Then, instead of just multiplying by a static number to see what happens over time, the time evolution is handled by a unitary operator acting on that entire function space.
The source actually brings in the Schrödinger equation here. And reading this, it finally made sense to me why Schrödinger's equation looks so intimidating. I mean, it has no solution if you treat it as a complex number.
No.
It demands a function space. It demands the gas phase so that the differential operators can kind of blow the gas around and preserve the history of the wave as it moves through time.
Exactly. Because the Schrödinger equation is linear, the full solution in the gas phase is the active superposition of both wave packets evolving simultaneously.
Right.
When you calculate the resulting probability density in this gas phase, the result isn't a single numerical answer. The result is a function that reveals beautiful spatial interference fringes. You can see exactly how the wave packets spread, how their widths change, and how the peaks and troughs cancel each other out.
Which real or complex numbers would have entirely missed?
Completely missed them.
It's like trying to describe an intricate symphony by just playing one single note really loudly. It doesn't work. You need the gas phase to hear all the instruments playing together over time, where the superposition perfectly retains the individual notes without blending them into white noise.
And that brings us to what I think is the most ambitious leap in the monograph. We have preserved the data of the universe's physical objects using the gas phase. We solved the differential equations.
Yeah.
But the gas phase treats the transformations of those objects as external forces. It is a system focused entirely on the objects themselves.
Right. The Hilbert space is just the arena where the quantum clouds float around.
But what if the information you absolutely need to preserve isn't about the objects?
Oh, wow.
What if the data loss is occurring because you need to measure and preserve the fact that two completely different types of transformations are intrinsically related to each other?
We are stepping completely outside the system now. It's the ultimate meta level. The source calls this the plasma phase, which is the realm of category theory, or the category of categories, Kat.
Yes.
When I was reading this section, the jargon was pretty dense, but an analogy formed in my head. Let me know if this tracks.
Sure, I'm there.
If the solid, liquid, and gas phases were us studying individual cities, like this city is the real number line, this city is the complex plane, this city is a Hilbert space, then transitioning into the plasma phase, like stepping back and realizing we need to map the actual highway systems that connect those cities.
I like that.
And then taking it even a step further, studying the abstract concept of highways themselves.
Let's build on that highway analogy, because it's actually a very accurate way to visualize category theory. In the plasma phase, we aren't studying the internal layout of the cities anymore. The cities are what the theory calls objects, and the highways connecting them are called morphisms.
Okay, so a morphism is just the road that lets you travel from one mathematical structure to another.
Yes. And if you have a vast network of highways in one country and a different network of highways in another country, a functor is essentially a master map.
Oh, functor. Yeah.
Right. It translates the entire highway system of the first country to fit the landscape of the second.
Right.
Without breaking any of the connecting routes. You are mapping relationships to other relationships.
It really is math about math. But how does this phase actually function? The text kept mentioning something called adjunctions, writing it out mathematically as F-VG.
Ah, yes. F adjoins G.
It sounded like the engine driving this entire plasma phase.
Adjunctions are the engine. You can think of an adjunction as a creation-destruction pair, or maybe more accurately, a build-and-forget pair.
Okay.
The left adjoint, denoted as F, is the force that creates new structure. It is the architectural mechanism that forces a phase transition upward.
Wait, so for example, the operator we talked about earlier that melted the real numbers into complex numbers.
Exactly. That was a left adjoint acting on the system to build new lanes on the highway.
And the right adjoint, G.
The right adjoint is the mechanism that forgets that new structure and pulls your perspective back down. It ignores the newly paved lanes to just look at the foundational dirt path that was always there.
That's fascinating.
The adjunction, the relationship between the building and the forgetting, is the mechanism that preserves the information that a phase transition even happened at all.
So by mapping how we build a higher phase and how we strip it away, the adjunction acts as a historical ledger, It proves that creating the complex numbers wasn't just a random invention, but the mathematically required path to solve the problem.
Yes. And exploring those relationships leads the monograph to one of its most profound conclusions. It's called the Yonnet dilemma.
The unit dilemma.
Right. In the context of our analogy, the Yonnet dilemma proves mathematically that a city is completely and entirely defined by the highways leading in and out of it.
Wait, I want to make sure I understand the weight of that. Are you saying an object in this plasma phase doesn't have an independent identity? It has no core essence.
None whatsoever. All the information about an object is preserved entirely in the network of its morphisms.
Yeah.
Think of a node in a social network. The node itself is blank.
Oh, I see.
It is defined 100% by who follows it, and how it interacts with the rest of the network. That is the Yonnet dilemma. The identity of a mathematical structure is literally just the sum total of how it interacts with everything else in the universe.
That is a staggering way to view reality. But, there is a logistical gap here that we need to bridge.
Which is?
Well, if mathematics is just a conceptual framework, if it's just symbols and logic,
Yeah.
it doesn't have a central nervous system. It doesn't have a brain.
True.
So it can't know when it's about to lose data. A real number doesn't feel pain when it hits a negative square root. So there has to be some sort of structural tripwire built into the equations themselves to trigger these phase transitions, right?
It's a great observation.
Yeah.
And the monograph addresses this exact gap with an incredibly cutting-edge concept. It's called the crystalline PHSM pi E framework, or CP pi E.
When I first saw CP pi E, I assumed the pi and E stood for the universal constants, like pi, the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter, and Euler's number, the base of the natural logarithm.
They stand for exactly that. But the framework redefines their purpose.
Yeah.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, think about computer science.
Okay.
In computer science, a checksum is a small algorithm that scans a block of data to detect errors or data loss before a file is transferred.
Right.
The CP pi E framework posits that pi and E act as literal, universal checksums running constantly in the background of the mathematical ecosystem.
But how do irrational numbers act as a scanner? What is the actual mechanism there?
Think about what pi and E represent. Pi governs boundaries, cycles, and rotations. Euler's number, E, governs continuous transformations and exponential growth. They are the limits of geometry and change.
Okay, I'm with you.
So when a rigid, lower-phase mathematical system tries to process a reality that is too complex for it, say a solid real number system trying to compute a continuous multidimensional rotation, it can't output a clean answer. The computation spits out an unresolvable infinite decimal featuring pi or e.
Ah, so the appearance of pi or e isn't just a random quirk of the math, it's an alarm bell.
Exactly.
It's an unresolved remainder that flags the system, saying, warning, you are trying to force a continuous reality into a rigid box and data is spilling over the sides.
The checksum fails. The pi or e anomaly detects the imminent data loss, and that unresolved tension effectively triggers the left adjoint.
The builder.
Right. It forces the system to execute a phase transition to a higher structure, like melting into the liquid phase, where that rotation can be processed cleanly without leaving a remainder. They are the guardians of mathematical information, forcing the evolution so the math doesn't forget its own history.
That gives an entirely new dimension to why pi and e show up absolutely everywhere in advanced physics, probability, and geometry. They aren't just numbers, they are the universe's internal error correction code.
It's a beautiful way to look at it.
Okay, we need to take a breath and look at the whole journey we've just taken. Mathematics is not a static list of rules to memorize. It is a living, evolving ladder of information preservation.
Right. We started on the solid, rigid ground of the real number line, the ice.
And when that ice couldn't handle negative square roots without losing data, the checksums triggered and it melted into the liquid plane of complex numbers.
Exactly.
When that liquid couldn't handle the physical, smeared out spatial reality of quantum wave superposition, it evaporated into the gas phase of function spaces. And when we needed to step outside the entire system to map how all those transformations related to each other, the math ionized into the plasma phase of category theory, where objects are defined entirely by their relationships.
Each transition is a necessary leap to a richer, more capacious realm of knowledge. The math destroys its own boundaries to conserve the full history of the computations.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? Why should you care about the phase transitions of Hilbert spaces or the Yonnet dilemma?
It's a fair question.
I think there is a profoundly human application to this theory. Whenever you feel stuck on a complex problem in your own life, your own work, or your own relationships, when you feel like no matter what solution you try, you are losing pieces of the puzzle and leaving collateral damage, it might not be that you have the wrong answer.
It might be that you are operating in the wrong phase of thinking.
Exactly. The framework you are using is too rigid for the reality of the problem. You're trying to solve a quantum human problem with a rigid, one-dimensional real number. You're trying to force a complex, spread-out, dynamic situation into a single definite point.
Which just results in data loss.
Right. Sometimes, to preserve the whole picture and actually find the solution, you have to let your internal framework evolve. You have to be willing to map the relationships instead of just staring at the objects. You have to melt the ice.
That is a highly practical way to interpret the theory. And mathematically speaking, the source text theorizes that this process of evolution we've mapped out today doesn't actually end.
Wait, there is something past plasma? What happens after category theory?
The conjecture states that there is no final ultimate phase. Beyond the plasma of category theory, there are things called infinity categories.
Infinity categories.
The monograph literally refers to them as the plasma of plasma, because the very act of a system achieving closure and understanding its own rules inherently creates the potential for a new, higher-order operation that will eventually break those rules. It is an infinite tower of junctions, building and forgetting forever.
The plasma of plasma, it just keeps scaling upward.
It does. Which leaves us with a truly lingering question. We've seen the historical triggers. The equation x squared plus 1 equals 0 broke the solid reals.
Yeah.
The Schrödinger equation broke the liquid complex plane. So if every new phase in the history of human mathematics was triggered by a specific impossible problem, what mind-bending, reality-shattering equation is waiting out there right now, just waiting to be written, getting ready to force the absolute next phase of human mathematics?
An equation that will force our current plasma to melt into whatever comes next. It definitely makes you look at that solid ice cube in your hand in a completely different way.